Just because
welcome everybody for coming. This is our first official meeting outside of the Roosevelt Feather meeting that we held at Linux Expo, which was, if you were there, enormously successful and really a great starting point. There's obviously a whole number of things we could talk about, but I'm going to keep it really brief to a few announcements that are relevant to our activities. I definitely recommend everybody gets on the mailing list, which is really where the brunt of the discussion happens. There's 50,000 things going on right now with the group, from putting together a logo, figuring out a logo, what looks too demonic, what doesn't. All the discussions, there's technical questions, there's BSD CAN coming up, which is in May in Ottawa, which we're going to be attending in one form or another. But what I'll do is I just want to say a couple of things. One, we're trying to redo the website instead of my open office version of the website. Michael's actually going to be coordinating people to be involved in that. We have a number of people from New York PHP in the room who will be involved, some design people. But Michael's going to be the point person. I recommend anybody interested in being involved at any level with that, talk to Michael. Michael's also a point person in terms of contacting and having our relations with the publishers. All the publishers, O'Reilly's, Sam's, and so on, have a point person who works for the user groups. Michael is that person on our end. So Michael is going to be divvying out books over each meeting and in between for people to review that we're going to end up posting on this new revised, exciting website, which I hope we'll have shortly. The last thing is just to introduce the speakers. There's more chairs. Just go in any of the offices. Jason Albanese and Wes Sonnenreich are authors of a book that just came out recently, published by McGraw-Hill, Network Security Illustrated. Really, I just went through it. It's a very, very strong overview of technical security. It's a dummies book, but it wasn't written by dummies. Like a lot of the dummies books, if you notice, there's holes in it. Well, they're not that dumb, I should say. But Wes also wrote a book that had a big impact on me, which was Building Linux and OpenBSD Firewalls, a book published by Wiley in either 1999 or 2000. One that really decisively came out and said, you can use Linux, you can use OpenBSD, but use the one that hasn't had has had one remote vulnerability in over 7 years. That really should be a starting point. So I'm going to let them take it and actually thank them actually for getting us this meeting space here tonight. This is meeting space that they're actually tenants of, so I can't really welcome them here since they should be welcoming us.
Hi, I'm Jason Albanese. Feel free to call me Jay, Wes. I'm going to give you just a brief background about both of us and a little bit about what we're going to talk about. We do have this book out. This is a poster that comes with it. I'll talk a little bit about that. We're really going to cover some of the aspects of what our book is on, which is how to integrate security into a business environment. But specifically, we're looking at OpenBSD tonight, being that so many people here are part of NiceBug, and how OpenBSD fits into a secure environment and some specifics about OpenBSD. To give you a sense of our technical proficiency versus our consulting proficiency, we weren't too sure what the levels of the people here would be tonight in terms of who's consultants, who are serious techies, who's a little of both, which of you work for companies, consult companies. So we tried to go down the middle and incorporate a little bit of everything. You'll have to forgive us for that, but we're going to leave time at the end for any questions that anyone might have on any of the topics. Currently, Wes and I own and operate a company called Sage Secure. It's a part product and part services company, and it focuses on, as you might guess, security-oriented products and services for businesses. In our current existence, both of us are, on a day-to-day basis, not too hands-on technical, meaning our software, which we coded and created, beyond developing that, on a day-in-day-out basis, we're not sitting in front of a OpenBSD or any other terminal all day. So there's probably a lot of people in this room that are more technically proficient in those terms than we are at the current moment. In our past lives, we have spent more of our days on a Unix terminal of some form or another, and we're trying to again address a little bit of everybody here and go down the middle with those general concepts. So if there are things that are either over your head or way under your head, we apologize for that, but ask any questions that you might have. One of the other general points I wanted to make in terms of OpenBSD versus all the other BSDs is probably the BSD that certainly I am, and certainly I think Wes too, are the most familiar with. It's got its own uniquenesses. It's a great operating system. We're very familiar with all that it can do, is the best way for me to put that. And we're going to try to touch on a lot of those components in our speaking. So at that, I'm going to let Wes get started. He's going to talk about OpenBSD and why it's secure by default.
The interesting thing about OpenBSD, which is its main differentiating factor between it and NetBSD and FreeBSD, is this philosophy called secure by default. And when Theo Durant created OpenBSD as a fork off of, I believe it was NetBSD at the time, his idea was to strip everything down, go through a complete code audit, and try and create a small core of NetBSD that was focused on completeness and security and correctness, so that this core would be stable and he could trust it, and then they could build out from there. So the design philosophy of OpenBSD and everything that's surrounding it has been based around this concept of make it secure, make it stable, and keep the feature set very small. As a result, it has a very, very different feel from almost any other operating system or distribution. There's no real amount of effort put into setting it up so you can put a disk in the drive and just immediately get going or have a quick install. In fact, the install program is probably the most daunting aspect of OpenBSD. If anyone's ever tried to do it, you put it in and immediately you have to know about hard disk geometries. And if you don't even get a little breather, you're right in the middle of F-disk, and it's not particularly that user-friendly. It's great once you get the hang of it. And actually, that's one of the funny things, is once you're familiar with it, it's actually 10 times more preferable to everything else, because then you don't have to go through the dumb menu trees of 20 different options. You can put in and out, and even though you know exactly what you want, it takes you 35 minutes to get the OS installed, or 5 hours in the case of Redmond-type OSs. So that's one of the nice things about their secure by default, is this whole concept of the minimal install. And in fact, the core install is very tiny. Then you decide whether you want your compilers in there, whether you want X in there, you want your man pages, and that's all before you get done with the install. And it's very simple, very modular, very tight core packages. Then once you get into it, you've got the whole BSD concept of packages and ports, and you can use that to expand out what you've got. Another major thing that OpenBSD has done is it's pretty much turned every service off by default. So when you install the thing, very little is running, very little is going on. In fact, the box is pretty much a rock. So it takes a little bit of work to turn enough stuff on that it can do whatever you particularly want it to do, but this is considered to be a good thing, because with all this stuff off, there's anything you turn on, you know you've turned it on, and therefore if there's going to be a security problem involved in something like, oh, we've got a security problem in SSH or Apache or whatever, you've somehow or other actively gotten these things started up so that you're aware of them. And awareness is a big aspect of OpenBSD. They do a couple of things which, you know, a lot of these concepts, by the way, have now migrated their way into FreeBSD and NetBSD. One of the things, because they're all BSD and they share so much of their core, there's a lot of cross pollination of ideas, of best practices. Each BSD sort of has its own focus. For those who might be familiar, one or the other. FreeBSD's focus is on generally speed and performance on a limited set of platforms, although their platforms have grown bigger over time, borrowing from NetBSD, which is sort of run it anywhere on anything, your toaster, your USB watch, whatever your pleasure might be at the moment. And then you get the OpenBSD, which sort of has a lot of the platforms that NetBSD has and some of the performance enhancements that FreeBSD has, but mostly everything scaled down. So, you know, when OpenBSD finds a bug in some core set of code that all three share, they fix the bug, and then usually the FreeBSD and NetBSD community work it into the patch process. Another major difference between all of these guys is the development cycle. OpenBSD releases twice a year, pretty much on like clockwork. And in between there's sometimes serious security fixes, they have patches, they have things like that, but generally you've got a pretty regular schedule, and they do that that way to sort of go along with their simplicity and ease of everything. I'm not sure about the development cycles for everything else, but they tend to be a little bit either less regular or more frequent or things like that. So it's kind of takes a bit of getting used to how the whole OpenBSD model works. If you don't, for people who might be familiar with Linux, you get these funny things where, like, when Red Hat goes from the 7 series to the 8 series, they change their glibc libraries, and suddenly now you can't really upgrade your box from one to the other because things just break. All sorts of things are moving in different. It's very chaotic. Things are going at different speeds, at different angles, trying to get a handle on everything. OpenBSD, everything sort of moves in a chunk. So when you go from 3.3 to 3.4, everything in 3.4 is designed to work together, and they make sure everything works stably, and that's sort of the model. So these are sort of some of the things that are going on with OpenBSD, and just a couple of quick things that they do with the secure by default. If you try and SU the root from a username when you're when you first start off, you're not in the wheel group, so you can't. So you have to log in as root and add your username to wheel. Yep.
That's an old BSD thing. Sonos did that.
Yep, that's.
It's not an open BSD thing. It's just BSD period.
Well, has that been in all the BSDs from day one?
It was in Sonos. The wheel, Sun killed that product about 4 years ago.
Right.
So
I just know from my experience, I found that things, certainly in the Linux world, that's not the case. It may be now, but it hasn't been for a while.
No, that's System 5. System 5 doesn't have the wheel group.
Right.
That's what they.
So, and as I said, a lot of these things are shared. Like OpenBSD's got sudo in there. You could add sudo in as any package, but it's in their core. They had just turned off binary emulations. For a while, they had binary emulations on in the kernel. They're compiled into the kernel, but they're now turned off. So if you want to run FreeBSD, NetBSD, Linux binaries, you got to turn it on. And the theory there was, well, it's too easy for hackers, if they do get access to a box, to just like run precompiled binaries. Let's make another step. Now they got to mess around with the kernel, which means they got to get root, which, depending on what user they got access as, may or may not be hard. In general, when they have their Common Core tools, they've done their own custom patches to it. So the Apache that comes with OpenBSD, that's in their standard core, has a few things done that they've tweaked there. Once again, it's all part of their general focus on security. They have a big thing about crypto. They're not Americans. They're generally based out of Canada, and they don't like Americans contributing to the development process, generally because they're afraid that policies in terms of whatever the current administration's theory on cryptography is, and that could change. They don't want to have any component of code where 2 years later somebody turns around and says, well, nobody can use cryptography anymore, the U.S. doesn't like it. So they have a bunch of decent algorithms in there, all the basic ones, but they have taken out any ones with things like patent conflicts, like some of the RSA algorithms, the IDEA algorithm. A major thing that the OpenBSD community has developed was OpenSSH, which has really benefited the entire open source world, because prior to that, there really wasn't a good open source SSH that had a license that was decent enough that everyone could use it wherever they want, and everyone knows SSH is pretty critical to any remote administration, and they've been sort of spearheading the development of that, and they, in a very short amount of time, have put together what is now pretty much the leading SSH app. They've got integrated curb 5, they've got their Apache, they've got set up pre with SSL, and they're running it now in a jailed environment by default. People who don't know what that means when Apache starts up, it just has no way of getting outside a particular directory. So if someone exploits Apache, they're not going to be able to, they may get access, but they're going to be locked into a certain directory on the system. And unless they can find another exploit to get them privilege escalation to root locally, they're going to have a very hard time doing that. Likewise, SSH has the concept of privilege separation, so it doesn't run as root. And once it runs, if you were to fuck somehow, I mean, there was a couple of major SSH exploits recently, but if you were using privilege separation, they didn't really hurt you. You get local access, but nobody could actually take that to root access. They had the first IPsec stack of anybody. They've been pretty much on the ball of trying to get IPsec integrated into BSD. They've been very active in trying to make their system work with crypto hardware, and a lot of this code, once again, is migrating into the other BSDs. They're random number generators. They've tried to put together a pretty secure pseudo random number generator and integrate it into everything. They also have S-key integrated into many things, and I happen to be a personal fan of S-key for a lot of reasons. Their commitment to security, they do frequent code audits still. They started off with a massive code audit, but they still continue to have a commitment to that. They've integrated the ProPolice for buffer overflows with compiling things. They actively, the community tries to keep on top of emerging security issues. So, one example is the first major problem in OpenSSH was an exploit. I'm going to get into this a little bit later, but it was an exploit in code that was actually designed to prevent an exploit due to a weakness in the SSH protocol. And so one of the things these guys have been doing is trying to keep on top of not just, looking in their own world of code audits, but what other people are thinking about theoretically outside in the rest of the world and how that may or may not impact what they have. And they've tried to make some changes to their own structure and to some of the code with varying degrees of success depending on where they've been. And finally, the idea of full disclosure. Anytime they find anything, they immediately patch it. They immediately report it everywhere. And, that has now gotten to be a fairly standard practice, but a couple years ago, really wasn't. Coming up. in fact, in a few seconds. But before I get into that last bit, they really have been a benefit to the whole community from what they've done. First of all, obviously the OpenSSH initiative has been a major benefit. They've detected a lot of multi-platform exploits that affect NetBSD and FreeBSD, and even some that flood over into Linux and Windows and other things. They detected those way in advance, notified the community, and a lot of some OSs and communities have jumped on faster than others in varying cases, but they're most importantly raising the overall level of awareness of security. Their existence, the fact that they perceive the need for this sort of a thing, has prompted a number of other operating systems that all of the BSDs have relooked at their internal structure and what they're doing. They've all taken security a lot more seriously ever since OpenBSD's come up. A lot of other operating systems have. And then finally, the most interesting thing about all the BSDs is their commercial viability because of the licensing. And the ability to take any BSD and use it as a core commercial product without having to worry about what that's going to mean for your company license-wise is a major win. And it has caused OpenBSD specifically, with its focus on security, to be very interesting to a lot of security hardware vendors who have used it to build as a core system for firewalls, as a core system for VPN devices. It makes it very easy for an independent consultant or a small consulting group to build a custom solution on top of and resell and not have to worry about the fact that, though, now I've got to worry about GPL access and all this other stuff. So the license is really a very important feature, not just for OpenBSD, but for everybody. Just to touch on some of the things that people are using OpenBSD for, probably the first uses were as routers and firewalls. IPF, years ago, was a great firewalling tool. Now PF is in its place, and it has matured enough that it's actually quite nice, too. I think it's definitely, in terms of user friendliness and in terms of features, it's way ahead of some of the other firewalling scripts in Linux, IP tables, IPNet, a couple of other things that are in the Linux world. Definitely ahead of IPF now. It's leapfrogged that. So it's an interesting thing. If PF is specifically associated with OpenBSD, you know, it has traffic shaping, it has load balancing built in, it can let you do secure logging. It's got a lot of neat features, but I might get to that later on. Other things it's being used as, VPN gateways, traffic shaping devices, intrusion detection systems. It's great as a standalone or a little to build a device on to run some sort of packet capturing utility to run Snort or something else on top of. It's also great as a secure logging endpoint. And finally, it's also great as a desktop environment. I happen to use it as a secure desktop environment where I can do a certain amount of things and trust at a certain level if I want to have my GPG keys on there. I don't feel bad having my GPG keys on my OpenBSD desktop because I think the odds of someone getting in there or if there being an exploit that lets someone get at those keys is pretty slim. So those are basically some of the thoughts on what OpenBSD is, some of its benefits, and, you know, as George said, it's had only one remote exploit in 7 years, which is a pretty impressive thing, knowing that if you buy one of these CDs and you stick it in your machine and you install it, the odds of somebody hacking into a default install, even if you forget about it, you don't keep up with your patches, you don't do this, you don't do that, all the things you're supposed to do, the track record's been pretty impressive. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to pass this over to Jay, who's going to give a talk about what this philosophy that OpenBSD has used in terms of being secure by default, what that actually means in practice in a number of different aspects of the business world and the technology world.
Thank you. I'm going to start by making a couple of comments. I'd be curious to know how many people in the room have used specifically OpenBSD. Okay, so a good percentage. And how many have used it in some kind of a business environment where it's in a live, working business environment? All right, so a little bit less. We have a certain amount of experience with that, in some cases successful, in some cases non-successful. And we wanted to talk a little bit about that and give some input there and later open it up for some feedback as well. So you have this operating system, OpenBSD, and it's arguably the most secure operating system in the world. That's fantastic. The parallel that we want to draw is that just because it's proactively secure doesn't mean that by using it in one part or all of your active live business environment, that therefore that business environment becomes proactively secure. And making your business environment proactively secure is something that you have to take the same approach towards in general as Theo may have taken towards OpenBSD as an environment in and of itself as a closed operating system. For us, proactively secure has a pretty specific meaning, and it means that you have the ability to take a look at your entire organization and from the ground up make decisions about how secure you want it to be and create a philosophy based on that. And then from that general security philosophy, really issue specific security policies that are going to be maintained, managed, and followed consistently throughout the organization. We believe that it's impossible to achieve total security. I think that's pretty obvious to anyone who's in our business or even tried to make any type of network secure. And as a result, the best you can hope to achieve that's practical is a level of security that is consistent and makes everyone in your organization happy. In order to do this, you have to have the luxury of planning, and a lot of organizations don't have that luxury. In our experience, most organizations that are networked have networks that have been built as the company has grown and are patched together, thrown on top of each other, and in many cases just a gigantic mess. So just network efficiency is a problem, let alone going into a network as a consultant and making that whole network secure. The approach to take in general, once you have a philosophy established and have generated security policy, is to consider software and security on the software and application level, which Wes will talk a little bit more about after I'm through, security on the hardware level, security on the networking level, and then operational procedures and how they affect security, literally physical security. It's obviously pretty silly to, you know, put a very proactively quote-unquote secure environment in place between your network, your operating systems, and your policies, and then not have locks on the server room door that would allow someone to, you know, easily walk in and socially engineer their way around all of your tight network security. And believe me, that goes on all the time. Okay. A couple of specific remarks about OpenBSD for those that haven't used it and or those that haven't used it in a business environment. It's one thing to use OpenBSD to secure your cable modem at home. It's a completely different thing to use OpenBSD to secure a business. And I'm not saying that it's a poor choice. It's got tremendous advantages. But it's not a simple matter of, okay, I know how to use it. I know how to install it. I know how to set up a firewall script. I know how to set up a VPN, etc. Let's roll it out. It's got a lot of things from it that are missing, so to speak, that take a lot of time to put into place that most commercial environments or business environments want. For example, redundancy is a particular challenge with OpenBSD and firewalls. It can be achieved. It's not easy to achieve. Most clients that we end up dealing with, it's far easier to tell them to just buy two Cisco PIX firewalls that are automatically redundant than it is for us to custom build them two OpenBSD firewalls on PCs that we make redundant. And as expensive as Cisco PIX firewalls may be, our time spent customizing BSD firewall solutions for them can often far exceed the cost of those two firewalls. So that's a general concept and a general theme. OpenBSD is great in some environments and not all too practical in others. And obviously, management is a serious problem of the operating system. You know, by default, because it's so clean and it's so tight, there's very few management tools, certainly no GUI. You know, putting OpenBSD in and leaving it behind in the client's office, or even if you're a network administrator and you expect someone else to be able to deal with what you did, forget it. It's virtually impossible. So it's not always the best practical solution unless you have a team of people that have a certain level of experience that they can maintain it going forward. That's just the kinds of realities we've ran into in the past trying to use it in practical working environments. Another general comment for people that haven't used OpenBSD in any environment, whether it be home or in a business, as Wes was saying, it is, you know, stripped clean and the services are very... Do you guys want to sit on this chair? It is stripped clean and it's got very few services installed by default. I have found, because I went from a really kind of a Linux background and before that an Amiga background into started using it, I felt that I was being punished. I was in this tight environment that I felt like the walls constricting me. It was very difficult. Once I got adjusted to everything and how it does everything, I found that it was so clean, straightforward, and simple that it was much faster for me to get around in and out OpenBSD than it ever was around Linux or any other Unix environment I had experienced. So I think for those of you that haven't tried it, the barrier to entry may be installing it. If you get past that and get familiar with not having Bash installed by default, I think you'll find that the way it organizes things make a lot of sense, especially in terms of thinking about security. Okay, where am I? Want to talk a little bit about the balance of security and convenience as it applies to OpenBSD, but in general as it applies to operating environments. In general, the more security you have, the more inconvenient it is for everyone. Just a fact. And the trick is balancing those two things, which is extremely difficult to do. We deal with clients that have way too much security, and as a result, and if a particular example would be recent HIPAA compliance issues. You have all kinds of companies, health insurance companies especially, because the doctors are not even bothering to comply, that have had a very intense reaction to HIPAA, and probably particularly intense because of what went on with Enron and their lack of compliance in other areas. The result is that employees of these companies that were used to doing things a certain way to get their job done just can't anymore. So there's a serious productivity problem. And it's not that the security they put in is necessarily even protecting the information any better. It's just making it more difficult in very simple terms for the people that work to get around barriers to do their jobs. You don't want to see that. On the other hand, more frequently than that, we see way too little security, and that leads me to this other interesting point, which is any business we've ever dealt with that has had what we would describe as zero security or way too little security for our liking has not thought that security was a problem for them at all. And they generally only find security to be an issue once they have a virus, Once a hacker has done something beyond just get into their systems, but actually downed their systems, or for whatever reason, if they've had the fortunate situation to recognize that someone broke into their systems and has taken information, which if you look at the average sophistication of a mid-sized business, which is who we normally work with, they rarely have the ability to detect that. So the point is that perception is a big part of security and dealing with security. People think that they only have a security problem if it affects them, and they're not aware that they may have a security problem that they don't even know about that might affect them 3, 6, 9 months down the line. So generally, you're seeing a tremendous amount of reactivity in terms of spending on security. Companies get viruses, they go and they buy the latest Norton package or what have you and install it. They think they got hacked, they go pay a consultant to put in a couple of firewalls, and they think their problem is solved. But they never look to bring people in to create a security plan for them that considers where they are now, where they're going to be, and what type of security philosophy they should have for their organization, and how they're going to maintain that consistently and balance between both... balance between what we call convenience and the right amount of security.
In customer sites that suffer from this sort of lack of coherence in terms of security strategy, do you find that they typically have a non-commensurate level of technical sophistication? They're doing smart things with their technology, but they're really not worrying about this one additional facet of operations, or are they putzes and they're kind of screwing the pooch across the spectrum?
That's an excellent question. And my honest answer is we see both extremes. One extreme we see is the scenario of putzes, where they don't know how to handle it, they wouldn't know if they tried, and they probably spend a lot of time avoiding it. Another scenario, we'll see technology departments within organizations that are very proficient, very talented, but they either don't have the time or the resources. Even if, assuming they had the skill, they don't have the time or the resources to focus on security. And the CTO of a company recently commented to me, and I was very glad to hear her say this, which her comment was this: in this day and age of where technology is at, she felt that things were becoming already so specialized that as a general chief technology officer of a mid-sized company, she shouldn't know that much about security. It's not her responsibility. She should be bringing in experts. The point I'm making there is, and I'm sure a lot of people have experienced this in any facet of being a technocrat, when you go into any organization or even talk to any person, people might be thinking about it now in terms of what we're saying. The tendency with people that are technology-oriented or technocratic is to be very defensive about what they have set up and to just be generally defensive about their knowledge. Now, I don't know why that is. It's just been my experience, particularly going into businesses and dealing with IT departments. They look at consultants very often as the enemy instead of as someone that's going to support what they've already done a decent job doing. And very often, there's only so much that IT departments can do because they have so much time spent just troubleshooting or just putting out fires. How can they sit down and take the time and or have the knowledge to create a proactively secure environment? It's virtually impossible. So we're looking to come in when we work with businesses from that general perspective and, not let the technology people be defensive about what we're going to say about what they did, because we want them working with us, not against us. So those are different things that we find.
Is there any way to talk perhaps about a distribution or a correlation? In other words, does it tend to be that on average, even technically bright people really haven't thought enough about it? Or is it the fact that, basically within a standard deviation and a half, most people are running shops that are kind of marginal in any case,
right,
no matter what the investment's in. On top of that, the problems are compounded by the fact that it's fairly weak.
Right.
People fall in that part of the curve.
Do you want to go ahead?
Yeah. I think a lot of the issue ultimately comes down to management and resources and what management is willing to spend money on. Right now, there's sort of a general perception that security is the sort of thing you can solve by buying some device or something, and very few companies are willing to even start thinking about a holistic approach to security. They just don't want to deal with that yet, and it's just a general cultural thing, and it's slowly going to change over time because it's going to have to. There's just no way that the black box device thing doesn't work. I mean, just look at the latest outbreak of the latest virus, the MyDoom thing. How many companies do you think don't have virus scanners right now? the statistics are amazing. Very few. Almost every company that you would think just got completely demolished by this, they've got virus scanners. They've got all these things. They just don't work. Because virus scanners and firewalls don't really work. Like, not when the management hasn't come up with a strategy for how information is going to flow around the organization that's consistent with the level of security that a virus scanner or a firewall could provide. So a lot of times the IT departments have no control over this because management is very clearly saying, look, just buy something. Here's some money. Buy something. Make the problem go away. The IT people are saying, you know, there's nothing we can really buy that's going to solve this until you change the way you're thinking about the way information moves through the organization, if they're sophisticated, or they're just saying, woohoo, money, let's go buy a firewall, you know? I mean, it depends on the IT organization, obviously. But
just take it a step further and to be very specific about your second question, it's my opinion, and simply that even technology-proficient people are not thinking about security. Not at least the way that Wes and I think about it. And, of course, the way we think about it is probably arguably sadistic, particularly because we wrote a book on it, and you become so entrenched in it. When we first started writing this book, out of the two of us, Wes was far more paranoid, and now I think I'm either on equal or above ground stature in that category. So sometimes when I have casual conversations with people about security and what the dangers are of not employing it, they end up calling me paranoid, and I'm getting used to that now. But that's a matter of perspective as well. But
no, everybody says this about
Yeah, exactly. But you know, we have a general vision, and it could be completely false. Our general vision is that beginning about now, but coming the next 5 years, that the whole IT world is really going to change because of a general lack of security that's out there, and the tools are so already available, and going to become even more so for any unskilled person to gain access to unsecured networks. That's really the crux of the problem. You know, you have script kiddies now. You have teenagers that don't have experience or skill that are able to do things because of tools that are out there and posted on the internet that they formerly could never get away with doing. You know, it used to be, let's say, a handful across the world of people that had the skill to hack into networks. And you could better believe that if they were doing it, there was some reason behind it. It wasn't just to randomly torture someone. And, you know, the hacker environment has changed dramatically, and no one has caught up to it yet on the security end, and that's what we want to see people achieve.
That brings up a question I was just going to ask. What do you see as the biggest threat, the script kiddies or the corporate hacker?
I think the script kiddies, I'll let Wes give his opinion as well, because I think that's the biggest mass danger. I mean, I think the corporate hacker is someone that is, you know, more out of the espionage novel, that's skilled and highly targeting what they're going for, and not that that justifies their cause, but it's going to probably be more like a razor than a shotgun, you know, and the shotgun approach is what scares me. You know, even what I've read about the MyDoom virus so far, which has caused already a tremendous amount of destruction, according to what has been found out, if there's any truth to it, it's essentially a group of people like us that are very angry about the lawsuits that SEO have going against IBM, and their plan is to launch a massive denial service attack against SEO's website. I'm sure you guys have read about this or whatnot. And
wait, I don't know.
Right, exactly. And the end result being that a lot of innocent bystanders have been badly damaged. Now, I'm, you know, not per se picking on people, but it's that shotgun approach that scares me, because it gets things out there that. You know, kind of have a steamrolling effect.
But, and to further take that point, I think that one of the issues is people are still thinking, okay, what's the bigger threat? Or, you know, what am I afraid of? But the real question is, like, what is more likely to do damage to you? And it's a risk management question. And that's sort of, when businesses start grappling with this issue, they're going to have to start grappling with it at a risk management level. It depends on what type of company you are. If downtime is a major concern for your organization, then you should be really worried about script kiddies, because that's the most likely source to come in and just wreak havoc on your network. If you work for a research company, government agency, pharmaceutical, whatever it is, where you have information where there's actually now a likelihood that there's somebody out there that actually wants to get in your network and get your information because they can profit from it, now you got to start worrying about that corporate hacker, because you're not so worried about the script kiddies. Okay, fine, you'll restore from backups. You've got a different time frame because you're doing research. But yeah, if someone steals it and gets a leg up on you in a competitive world, well, that's a totally different problem. So it's really, it becomes a balance of risk management. One of the things we talk about in our book is what we call the disaster spectrum, which on one side is the disaster of downtime and not being able to access your information. And certain types of organizations fall into there. And on the other side, like professional service firms, anyone who bills by the hour, if they can't get at their data, they've got a real problem. On the other side, you've got the R&D firms, where they're worried about people breaking in. And then a lot of IT firms and, you know, people like us, we sort of fall in the middle where it's bad on both ends. We're kind of screwed because it makes our life that much harder. But that's a general concept. So when you look at it from that risk management angle, it really depends on who you are as to what the answer to that question is. George?
Maybe we could shift a little bit of focus because, Wes, you talked a bit about ProPolice and the effect the defensive ability has enhancing the ability to stop buffer overflow attacks, which, I mean, buffer overflow attacks are, you know, older than me, you know.
Right.
Buffer overflow attacks, you know, are essentially, you know, go back to the beginnings of the internet and, you know, real computing in the 60s. But I was wondering, Wes, maybe you could kind of address that a bit.
Sure. One of the things we were going to start getting into, one of the real-world concepts is proactive security in programming and what that really means.
Don't use C++.
Well, you know, it doesn't help either if you use PHP with registered globals on. So,
I wanted to say it, obviously.
There are...
Look at me funny.
At this stage of the game, there are quite a lot of different techniques that you can use to take a program that you write and make it a heck of a lot more secure. But all of those techniques have one thing in common, which means the day you decide to start writing a program, you also decide you're going to make that program secure. Because the amount of time and effort it takes to reverse, once you've got the program written, go through and try and make it secure, as especially if you're a PHP hacker and you've tried to take any code that was written in the old pre-registered globals day, and try to get it to work now with registered globals off, and try to also look for all the other millions of mistakes they made from a security concept, you might as well rewrite the app from scratch. If you're thinking about, if you have to do development in C or C++, and even if you're dealing with Java, I mean, there's still things that can get you, because security, when you're programming, is a design level issue. You have to think about not just, am I going to get a buffer exploit, but it actually turns out, we work with a couple guys at Stake, which used to be the Loft. They're doing a lot of application security work, and they've gathered a lot of statistics. And buffer overflows aren't actually the number one cause of security problems, as they found. They're number two. But number one is actually...
Users.
essentially, it's basically password issues and session hijacking and replay attacks, which is the ability for the application being designed in such a way that when someone logs in or gains access to the system, that information is capturable or replayable, and whether that's done on a social engineering level or whether it's they just never really thought through it. How are people going to actually log into this practically? They put in a system that's too complex, and then they have to create a workaround that just creates a back door. So there's a large amount of your design. When you sit down, you have to say, all right, I want this thing to be at a certain level of security. How much time am I going to spend? What trade-offs do I have to make? Then once you've got that decision, now you can start saying, well, I'm going to compile this thing. If I got to compile it, I'm going to link in something like ProPolice. So at least I have some level of defense against buffer overflows. I'm going to try and not program them that way, but I may screw up. I'm going to run a bunch of different code auditing tools that exist to try and look for some of these problems. Then, once I've got past a certain page, I'm going to try and get other people to look at my code, to look at the source, to peer review, which is why it's really nice if you're developing as open source. And your business model allows you to do that, that you can get peer review on something. And then, you know, moving forward, not assuming that you've got something that works, but constantly testing it, trying to get feedback from your users, trying to watch when things break, trying to anticipate things. And there's no easy solution to it, but it is just, it's a way of thought, and it's something you really have to, kind of integrate into the way you approach things. saying choose this language over that language. I remember at one point that everyone thought that would be the great thing about Java, you know, super security, and you know, it just doesn't work that way because there's some problem in the Java library here or there. So they get rid of five more, and five more come up because next year Sun's going to release Java whatever, and it's going to have 10 new features that weren't in last year, and five of those are going to have security exploits in them that they didn't catch. So it's an ever going on cat and mouse game. Our sort of approach to this whole thing is just assume your application is insecure, and now try and figure out how you can set up your business processes around that so that you minimize the amount of damage that's done. And that's a lot of talk, this probably goes a little further than what we have time to do here, but you need to do both. You need to take the proactive approach in terms of the coding. You also need to try and think of it on a managerial level. Okay, you want to, George, do you want to go down a road in any other direction there?
I was just wondering specifically about the Propoly stuff, if you could talk about that, because that's kind of been one of the big hot issues. I mean, on bug track, if people know about bug track, huge debates about that.
As to whether or not it works?
Well, whether or not it works and whose code it was and whose idea it was and so on. I mean, that was a whole side gossip thing. But
I mean, that's one of the problems with something like ProPolice is, you know, people assume, all right, I'm going to link this in and now I'm good. Like anything. I mean, that's been the problem with any security device. Someone gets it, they include it, and they assume now I'm fine, now I don't have to think about security anymore. It's a tool. It's great if you have a need for it and you know what it's going to do for you and it fits into your plan. But, you know, a lot of people have looked at this. I mean, there was a huge amount, not just ProPolice, but there's a lot of other equivalent things out there where people have been trying to take a programmatic solution and say, I'm going to write code that's going to solve all these security problems and all this other code. And it's like a perpetual motion machine. You just can't build it. Because eventually there's going to be a problem in some core component somewhere or other, and it's never going to go away. At the end level, as you said, George, there's the user to deal with. And that's most likely going to be the source of your error.
And either way, in general, hacking or breaking into any system that's perceived as secure is just about circumvention. So as soon as you plug up one hole, people are just going to go around it and look for another hole.
Let me give you an extreme sort of thing. Let's say you had the most secure computer in the world. It's in the middle of the room, Mission Impossible style, where, you know, but there's no vent that Tom Cruise can hang down on a rope from or anything stupid like that. It's just super secure. But some guy's got to get in there and use it. Now, this guy's clearance is impeccable. He's brilliant, all right? But somewhere in a lab, somewhere in the Netherlands, they've been messing around with nanites and technology, and as this guy's walking down the street, a guy sprinkles a little bit of powder, which has a couple of different tiny little nanite-type robots, which once he goes into that room, then manage to gain access directly to the computer. Either they've got little cameras and they can see what he's doing, or they can sense what's going on, or they get into the actual system themselves. This stuff isn't, by the way, all that ridiculous or that far-fetched, if anyone has any idea what's going on in nanotechnology or computing. And believe me, if someone really wants to get at that information, they'll find a way. That may be a little more extreme, but they'll find some other way. Or they'll just basically say, if you don't go in there and get me the data I want, I'm going to kill your family. I mean, someone's got to get at the information.
And it's the same principle in any organization as a firewall. You know, every business out there in the last 5 years has purchased a firewall to block ports on their network, and now every exploit just goes over port 80, and every firewall has to have port 80 open. So what's the point of a firewall? It has some purpose. I'm exaggerating slightly, of course, but the point is that you're just going to go through the hole you have to have open. You need to use the internet if you're a business. Otherwise, what's the point of being connected? Which is an extrapolation of exactly what Wes means.
Without the nanites.
without the nanites, right. At least for now. I just have a couple of other comments, and then I'll let Wes finish up, and then we'll take any other questions you have. Remote access is just something I wanted to touch on in terms of general network proactive security planning. Most people in any kind of an organization want remote access at some point, and as soon as they want it, it's like toppling a brick wall or putting a big hole on. You know, of course, remote access is going to be a problem for any kind of security design. One of the things that we like to assume, which I'm just going to throw out there for people to think about, is you know, even if you have a web-based remote access system, the problem is that, you know, you're going to try to log into it from some other person's computer or from your computer from home. It's an environment that's not controlled, assuming that your office environment is completely controlled and tight and locked down. You leave it, and whatever environment you're on is not controlled, whether it be an internet cafe, your home computer with Windows 98 on it running on an old Dell, whatever it is, it's probably been hacked into if you're the average user. And the end result is that you're now logging in remotely from one of these machines, and it very well could have a keystroke logger on it, and then your password's gone. So a great tool to defend against that in general, and is the only tool that we like to use when dealing with remote access for ourselves, getting clients to use it as another story, would be S-Key. And it's something that I advise everyone to look into if they have not. We're not going to get into it specifically. S-Key.
It's a one-time password system where basically you can generate a number of passwords that you can use. They're these funny little four-letter words strung out. And so you can carry a couple with you, or if you have a Palm Pilot or something, you can download generators where if you type in your secret phrase and the proper challenge, it'll generate the response. The advantage of this is obviously if you're in a cyber cafe and you're trying to log in somewhere, you don't have to worry because the password you type in won't ever grant anyone access in the future. But obviously, this is never going to fly with your average company unless it's put in a commercial product, which is why the RSA Secure IDs, which I'm sure many of you have seen, are very popular. They use the same mechanism as S-Key.
But you pay a lot of money for it.
Right. S-Key, S/KEY.
This is something from a long time ago, right?
Oh yeah, no,
it's
very old.
Right.
Absolutely. It's definitely an old concept. There's some issues about whether it's secure or not on certain levels, or there's all sorts of things with it. But if you've got to deal with this sort of situation and you're a system administrator and you've got to get into systems, OpenSSH definitely supports it. Telnet supports it. And
of course, no one here uses Telnet. Nothing to worry about there.
Although I got to tell you, if you're in a situation where you are now remotely accessing something from an untrusted machine, it really doesn't matter whether you use Telnet or SSH, because you can't just. I mean, the odds are actually far higher that there's a keystroke monitor on a machine that you're actually accessing than that someone's actually being able to intercept your data and decrypt, or even capture the plain text, because. Basically, you know, the theory is, all right, I'm connecting to this machine over the internet, it goes all over the place. Really, the way the network is structured these days, you're going over a set of a backbone from point A to point B. The number of uncontrolled machines in between, it really isn't that high. Whereas the odds that the cyber cafe you're at was owned by the guy that was having a double chocolate mocha latte thing before you, you know, that's pretty high since I've done it myself.
But the point being, remote accessing.
it's a great way to
remotely accessing system.
Go ahead. Can you put an S key like right into the root of like all your logins for OpenDSP?
Absolutely.
How does it interact with the system? How does it fit with it? Can you just explain that?
Okay, so you get, basically, instead of your login where you give your username, and instead of a password, it says S key, and then it gives you a number, like a few letters and a number. That number's your challenge. And then it'll give you a code, and then it'll give you actually two numbers. One's like an identifier, and the other's a number. Let's say the number's like 495. If you've generated 500 one-time passwords ahead of time, first you generate the passwords, then it gives you the number, which one to use, and it goes down a list one by one. And the other thing, the identifier code, is if you have an S-key generator, you put that code in, and then the challenge passphrase you used to generate your list of codes, and it'll generate the response you key in. You key that in, you're in.
So does this integrate with OpenSSH, or does it integrate with your Getty, or what?
It's integrated at the... Well, it's integrated with quite a lot of the... anything that pretty much makes a call to the log. I'm not sure. Programmatically,
supports PAM. You should be able to do
right.
I figure
it's got PAM support, and I think
it's pretty much done. It's integrated with logins. It's integrated with SSH.
Yeah, I mean, if you set it up right.
Absolutely. And from the strategy perspective, you know, remotely accessing your network and not using SK, it's just, the two concepts just really contradict each other, but most people don't use SK, which is interesting. So
another thing, just in case you're trying to think about using SK with something like Apache, one thing to wonder, you know, the problem with the web is every time you load a page, you're making a separate connection. So unless you have some system that basically caches your login, you'll have to provide a new SK every page refresh. So it's tricky to get it to work correctly with web-based apps. It can be done, but it requires a sort of an intermediate stage of caching that information.
You can write a CGI to do it easy, though.
Yeah, you can. There's a lot of ways to do it.
You're not using HTTP authentication.
Well, no, if you're using a CGI, it's still going to, every time you do it, it's still going to be a new challenge.
Well, if your CGI thing's a PAN module,
yeah,
and it provides
that. Yeah, I mean, as long as SKI gives you some kind of module that you can integrate with, I'm sure it does. It'd be very easy.
Well, through PAN is basically what it is. Yeah, but it's doable. It absolutely is doable. It's just not as straightforward as like it just plugs into SSH, it plugs into everything else. What I'm saying is, if you try and plug it just straight into like HTTP authentication, it isn't going to work for you the way you want it to. So
anyway, I'm wrapped up. I'm going to let Wes finish. Only final point I want to make is that trying to maintain consistent, proactive security policies is the best thing you can do, whether for your own organization, for anyone you're working with. To not do it kind of really undermines the whole point of building a secure environment. And we find that a lot of people do undermine the point of building a secure environment by doing things that contradict themselves like that. So those are things to look out for in broader strokes and in terms of being proactively secure. Wes is going to go a little bit quickly now into OpenSSH and some breakdowns that occur no matter what you do, and then we'll just wrap up and take any last-minute questions.
Yeah, I was just going to, I mean, I'm actually going to move through even faster than that. I had already talked a bit about OpenSSH. You know, there were a couple of pretty big exploits that had happened with that over time, and a lot of people were like, oh, you know, I mean, that is their one remote exploit that OpenBSD experienced was through OpenSSH. And a lot of people see all of these, you know, exploits and problems as a failure in the system, but it's actually kind of a success of the system in a way, because until OpenSSH came around, people weren't even really looking at SSH in this way. They weren't really pulling apart the code, looking for all of these problems. The fact that you had a solid core group of people that was really dedicated to moving this forward in a certain way and making the code readily available and easily available helped people look through it and audit it, and a lot of things have come up, which has made all of the SSH implementations a lot more secure. And ever since, really, they decided to go the privilege separation route, almost everything that's shown up since then has pretty much been a very limited impact if you use privilege separation.
Which is the default.
What?
It's the default.
Yes, it's now default. When it first came in, it was not for 3.2. Now it's on for default. I don't know why anyone would turn it off, but I guess some people might want to. I don't know. The other thing that's interesting, just to see one of these sort of business level decisions that impacted OpenBSD directly, was to switch over from IPF to PF. Sometime right around when 2.9 was, right after 2.9 was released, Theo and Darren Reed, who wrote IPF, got into a giant pissing contest over licensing agreements. And basically what happened was, the license that Darren releases IPF under is not truly a full BSD-style license. And at one point, he would have been actually kind of amenable to just changing it to the BSD license, but if anyone's kind of watched Theo in full flame mode, they know he can piss people off real fast. And so they basically got into a bit of a hot dispute.
Wait a minute. I read the emails. He actually claimed, Darren Reed claimed that no, it was never allowed for you to actually...
Well, things went.
Distributed the code or whatever, so it actually was never really truly free. So he was ambiguous about it, and then later on, the Rod said, forget, out of the tree, something else. And then he came back with a new license and said, okay, fine, now it is. Because again, it's too late.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it was a very complicated, the argument went back and forth at a lot of different levels. One point's on the list at that point. But yeah, you're right. Basically, Darren had a certain license on there where the technical interpretation was that it wasn't free. But then Theo's react, like they got into it at a debate where they both sort of stood up and they're like, I'm not going to budge. And then finally when Theo pulled the cord and said, well, you're just not in here anymore. Because he didn't, they just didn't think that he would do that, because that basically left 2.9 stable without any sort of packet filter. And with most people using OpenBSD for firewalling code at the time as a firewalling box, you know, but Theo had PF as a replacement.
That's the strength that he does. Basically, just forget it. I stop talking to him. I'm just doing myself, and that's what
absolutely. Now, what that did, unfortunately, was by doing that, Theo went away from his mom for a little while. And luckily, doesn't seem to have gotten bitten by it, but just to say what I mean, PF is different from IPF in a number of ways. First of all, it focuses on features. It's got a built-in support with AltQ for traffic shaping. It's, they've had load balancing. They started off with mostly IPF functionality, but they started to add in a whole bunch of features, different ways of writing the rule set, and it's great. It's far nicer to write rules in PF for most cases than it was in IPF. But the problem with that is, A, it was hasty to get that code in there. The first version of PF, I just recommended to everyone for 3.0 and 3.1 that you actually shoehorn IPF back in there, but that's a pain. Now it's actually a lot more mature. But for a while there, you had code that is very tightly integrated with the kernel and is really not truly being done in the OpenBSD mentality. So I'm still not 100% sure there aren't a number of attack vectors available. There have been a couple of security bugs found here and there with PF, but there's a number of areas with such as the traffic shaping and the load balancing and a couple other things where...
Always fingerprinted.
Hmm?
Always fingerprinted.
Oh, with the PF letting you do that? Yeah. I mean, that's, you also have that OpenSSH also sort of gives away a little bit of information too on that. But in general, I'm still thinking that there could be remote root exploits that come in through that. And it's just one of those things that sometimes you have a business decision for one reason or another that forces you out of that mode. And if OpenBSD was being operated really in a sort of business thing, they may not have, you know, there may have been some attempt at reconciliation and more of a migration pattern into PF over time, but that's just not how it worked out. So I'm not saying right now that you could own boxes that are running PF easily or not, but I'm just saying the process that happened in between that period of time is definitely the sort of thing where if you're ever wondering what hackers look for when they're trying to find places that might have potential holes and exploits, they look for situations like that where they know things were going on a little crazy and people were rushing around and trying to get stuff in there. So it's just sort of a little bit about that. And other than that, this question to George, you might want to sort of take over for a bit if people have to go, so you can address them.
Just we're going to try and pull, I guess we can get our 15 minutes. We'll try to get as far. Wes, do you want to make a recommendation for a bar in the neighborhood?
What's the one that we...
That's one of them. It looks like the next meeting, we talked to Jeremy Song from Wasabi, it looks like the next meeting is on NetBSD and embedded systems. People don't know Wasabi. Wasabi is a commercial... incantation or whatever, NetBSD basically, where they focus on, among other things, on embedded systems. So that looks, we're going to get an engineer from NetBSD the next meeting. But if you're on the list, we'll know that anyway.
So it's
going
to be here.
What's the next meeting?
First Wednesday month. If you get on the list, you'll it's
there's a restaurant called the Tomato that serves probably the most expensive burger within 5 miles, but they actually have a nice bar that's sort of set up in a way that it can fit a bunch of people and that the beers are normal New York beer bar prices.
You should also announce that you have an announce list now, right?
Yeah, we also have an announce list.
You don't have to get a tie.
You don't have to be involved in the esoteric
debates. So that bar is on 6th Avenue down two blocks, either 20th...
21st.
Yeah.
21st and 6th.
So that's probably the best place for us to meet if it's close by. And
does anyone have any other questions about this stuff before we go?
Yeah?
Yeah, real quick. In the
context
we're talking about PF and
can you tell us what IPFW? It's definitely it's FreeBSD and NetBSD's packet filter, correct?
NetBSD is $10, I think.
OSX.
What? Oh, it's Darwin's now. I mean, yeah, it's sort of going on its own thing. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I haven't kept really tabs on where IPFW is. Last time I checked, it was very, very similar feature to feature with IPF. They just went about a number of things differently. I'm sure they're probably keeping up. IPF has not kept up with the direction PF has gone. It's just trying to stay on its core. PF is more on the feature thing. You can hook things in and make it more like PF, but they've tried to, at their pace. I don't know which direction IPFW has gone, but I can take a look at it.
How do you do about SSL? I have a website set up SSL and then logging behind the SSL.
That's actually, I mean, that's definitely one of the things we use. It's great for securing the connection in between, you know, your web browser and the site you're logging into. The problem is, what's your endpoint?
Right.
If you're logging in from any machine you don't explicitly know is 100% secure, you have to assume that someone can get a keystroke logger on, then they've got your username and password, and now the SSL really doesn't do you any good because they'll just replay it.
Right, so you have the same S-key kind of concept problem. SSL will do a great job of encrypting that transmission, but not what happens before the transmission.
But it is definitely a great option.
How do you do that if you have users you have no control?
Again, it goes back to what I was saying before. You know, and we're not suggesting that every environment, these extreme things should be done. We're trying to point out a balance of what some of the intense and more extreme tools are out there that are available, and yet also make the point that it doesn't work to use them in every environment.
Well, you also, basically what you have to do is you have to just ensure that if a hacker gets in through any one of those user accounts, there's a limit to the amount of damage they can do. That it's, you basically put the responsibility on the user, saying, if you use this from an insecure endpoint and someone gets your username and password, they can get at all your stuff and delete all your accounts or any information associated with your account. But on the back end, you just want to do as much as you can to isolate that so that there's as little chance of a privilege escalation into other user zones.
Question.
Yeah.
I heard that the only way to get rid of loggers is to actually reinstall the OS.
That's the only way I would ever get rid of it.
That doesn't even work.
Really?
Well, the reason is there's a number of keyboards.
You
can buy some really nice ones.
Okay. You could buy a keyboard from
MBR.
I mean, it.
No, it's like $50 now. It looks like a PS2 adapter.
Exactly.
It logs everything in the hardware.
Database is running on OpenBSD.
Yeah, maybe for example, like SQL or something.
We do that.
We feel great about it.
We run Apache on it. Now that everything sort of works together nicely on OpenBSD, I feel much, much more comfortable running a web server off of OpenBSD as long as I don't need some CGI that has been compiled for Linux. I feel much more comfortable running the web server, the back end, either MySQL or Postgres, off OpenBSD, just because I know there's nothing else going on in the background, and also I know Apache's chrooted. I know that everything is sort of got the it just is a lot easier to maintain. But of course, if you need MySQL, like if you're using MySQL and you want MySQL 4, of course you can't use that with PHP. So.
There's some limitations that you have to look into. I mean, in the past, what we did, and to this day, actually, we still have to make a major overhaul. All of our servers in our co-location facility that hosts a lot of our client database data and our own websites, et cetera, are currently running Red Hat 9. And
we're not giving you the IP address.
Yeah. And we're not giving you... Right.
What's your IPs?
Yeah.
I made that mistake once. I actually gave I was teaching a building firewalls course, and what I had on my handouts, I had actually had... our sample rule set from our firewalls, and I had forgotten to change the IP addresses. And so,
People during the talk we were giving were actually hacking into one of our servers.
So I told Jay to take over, and I immediately went in and just shut down all our servers.
That's a good question.
Well, it's not a multiprocessor operating system, so that's something to know about. But it's pretty lightweight, so as long as what you can do on the one processor or in a cluster works, I mean, I certainly wouldn't start thinking, if you've got an environment where you've got scalability issues where OpenBSD running on your latest Intel or AMD hardware, it's so light and the power of that hardware is so much that unless you're doing something that's really crunching massive amounts of data, well, you shouldn't be thinking about OpenBSD anyway from a business point of view. You should be going with a vendor that can really provide you with the right amount of support for that,
right,
unless you've got the resources to support it yourself.
The problem is, it's very arguable, and what Wes is making an excellent point, which I agree with fundamentally. PC architecture now, you're buying a 2-3 gigahertz processor. I mean, what that can do with OpenBSD is really boundless, but the problem is there's no quantifiable way to gauge what kind of volume of traffic an OpenBSD PC can really handle.
Right.
And we don't even have any, I've implemented in environments where it's crapped out on me for no reason that I can't explain why. Maybe there's a driver issue with the particular network cards I had in there at that time. Who knows? Other times I've seen it handle endless amounts of data flow and not even bat an eyelash. So because you can't quantify it, it's dangerous to rely on it. And on top of that, you have the argument of the support issue. It's the old saying about it's always easy to go IBM because whoever made that decision will never get spanked for it.
Is there a commercial infrastructure to support OpenBSD akin to Red Hat or SUSE or Linux?
There's commercial products that are built on top of OpenBSD.
The answer to his question is no.
Pay me money.
Yeah, right. The answer to your question is no. There's no commercial organization that has taken OpenBSD and packaged it the way a Red Hat has or a Mandrake has, etc.
There's no reason why someone couldn't.
Right. There's a lot of hardware devices that have taken OpenBSD, modified it to their liking, and use it to create their secure OS on their particular black box system.
No. It will run on pretty
much
broad amount of hardware. I mean, 3.2, they removed the Amiga support, unfortunately. But
our practical experience with it is with PC architecture, but it does run on other architectures.
I mean, it did fork off an FBSD, so it has a lot of portability. It runs a lot of hardware. We've only had a couple of pieces of hardware where it's had trouble, and that, of course, has been Intel boards, where they've had integrated Intel chipsets, and we've had trouble getting the video to drive at the resolution we wanted it to drive at, mostly because Intel just kind of sucks that way.
But that's assuming you want X anyway. We actually use OpenBSD in workstation environments, so we've run into that problem.
This is an observation. There was by some Slash dot posting a relatively comprehensive and technical breakdown of Linux, FreeBSD, and OpenBSD. And although OpenBSD, in fact, absolutely held its own, it really was substantially trounced in terms of scalability at very high connection
absolutely.
And transaction rates. It's really not built to do that. But it's interesting. It's analogous to taking a plane up and knowing its performance envelope. You really don't want to crack the wings off, but it's nice to know exactly how much of a tight loop you can do in it.
That's right.
Go up.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why it's very difficult to put it in a particularly large business environment, because if something happens, man, are you going to get in trouble?
We'll take one last question.
Yeah, I heard a rumor that OpenBSD was working on building VM virtual machine capability into the operating system, so you could, let's say, build a firewall with multiple virtual machines within it to really partition it into one box.
They implemented, I think right after 3.4 came out, they imported CARP, Common Address Redundancy Protocol, which takes care of basically it's a BSD license, DRP or HSRP basically, and I think that might be what you might be talking about, is sort of the
Multiple computers inside your computer, but wouldn't it be great if you had an OpenBSD box, you could run multiple OpenBSDs within your OpenBSD box.
Gotcha.
And then you could have partition firewalls.
Go to IBM, buy a mainframe. Doesn't
you
Yeah.
On previous games, I put all my services in jail. That's pretty similar. No, it's not that. It's not that for jail. I think it's but isn't that redundant? I mean, I don't know. It's not that. But it's, I don't think HAM is turned on by default.
I know what you're saying.
I don't think it's turned on by default.
The hardware is pretty cheap. And we generally
turned on by default. That's what
they do. We just make them very specific devices. We consider them like toaster ovens. You know, we need something to do accents. It's just going to do, we need 5 toasters, we'll get 5 toasters. But it doesn't really, we're not trying to do anything fancy.